it is a blessing to get to be back here with you again. It has been a while. I don't know exactly how long that a while is, but it's measured in years. I've so many fond memories of coming to this building and this place when I used to be able to make more regular work trips into the area. And, you all have always provided a Bethel spot to come and to kind of get away from the things of the world for a while. I have wonderful memories in that regard, and you're a part of that. Brother Michael mentioned the travel trouble coming over here today, and I want to share that, and there's a point to it. I was in Ohio the last couple of days, and the plane was supposed to leave this morning or late morning. It was going to get me into Atlanta in plenty of time. We got on there, everything looking perfect, and I'm all settled in and buckled, and then they come and tell us the hydraulics aren't working. Everybody's got to get off the flight. And then they tell us that they're going to fly another plane that has it with some parts in, and that they don't know whether the flight's going to go to leave today, tomorrow, whatever. And I started getting a little bit nervous. So before we even got off the plane, there's a large plane, 100-something people on it. I called my travel agent. They said, you know, there's one other flight that leaves in the mid-afternoon that would come into Atlanta and get there by 5 or 5:30, but that is completely full. You can either get one that's late tonight or tomorrow. And so I told Brother Michael that. And there were a lot of people ahead of me in the lines, and I went ahead and stood in the line. And finally, I saw this other little shorter line over there, so I got out. After about a half hour, I went and stood in that line. And this guy was right in front of me, and he was fixing to walk up there, but he had to take a phone call. And so he moved out of the way and let me come up, and I just said, "Man, is there any way can you put me on a different airline, send me to some other city and find a way to get me?" And she ran to the computer, and she said, "Well, that's odd." And I asked her what it was. She said, "Well, the very next flight, you know, the one that all 100 people in front of me had been trying to get on that was full." She said, "One seat just opened up on that." I said, I will take it. I even gave her a hug. And I get to the Hertz counter in Atlanta, and they say, "Mr. Green, we don't have any record of a car for you." Lord, help me. So there was some, we worked out that issue and got in the car, and then coming down here, I'm like, what is it, 96 or something that I'm on? And it tells me that about 5 miles down the road is going to be Pleasant Plains Church Road. Well, out of the corner of my eye, I see a road, and it just looks too familiar. And I stop a little bit. You know, Stuckey Road has got that. And I looked at that sign, and I said, "Stuckey, that sounds too right." So I ignored Google Map Lady, turned on that road, and got here. And I tell you that just to say, once the lady said, "I have no idea why one seat just opened up on a flight that 100 people before me couldn't get on," it gave me a bit of assurance, as it were, that most folks, because I've had a subject on my mind all day long, and maybe everyone in this building may not get a thing in the world out of it, but I'm convinced that there's going to be one person, at least, but if there's just one, that God has arranged so that I'd be here, and whoever you are would be here, and that His Spirit would apply it in such a way. And that gives me confidence to move forward and say, "Lord, Thy will be done." So I'm thankful, and I magnify His grace in what was, well, His providence. There was no other way around it. I can assure you, my normal travels, that it doesn't work out that way. It just doesn't work out that way. Turn with me for just a moment over to the 5th chapter of the book of Ephesians. You find a verse that's a familiar one to us. It's verse 16 of Ephesians chapter 5. It says, redeeming the time because the days are evil. The older I get, the more I observe that to be the case, the more I observe that to be true, that the days are evil. And they're evil in a couple of different ways. One, the society that we live in becomes much more anti-Christ as the days go by. We're not living in a society that's becoming more inclined towards God. We recognize that and we feel that, and shamefully, I am affected by it. I'm certain that things that cross my vision without any degree of shock value whatsoever on my part, my grandfather at my age would have blushed. It would have felt shame to see things. So we don't live unaffected in those evil days. But I also realize more and more every day that goes by, both through just watching and through personal experience, the truth of what Solomon said at the end of Ecclesiastes when he says that there are evil days that come upon the life of an individual. Living simply gets harder. It just gets more difficult. It has more pain. There's more worries that seem to come. My brothers-in-law, I've got four of them. They're fine men, but they're getting to where they kind of roll their eyes at me, because I'm all the time telling them, because they're about 10 years behind where Ashley and I are in terms of the ages of our families. And I keep telling them, guys, eat it up. You have no idea what's right around the corner. You know, and they kind of give me that, that's our crazy brother-in-law, look and go on. But I get that now in a way that I didn't before. The problems become larger. You know, the weights that you see on them become larger. The days simply become more evil. So the Apostle Paul here, writing to the church at Ephesus, tells them to redeem the time. Tells them, get something back for it. For every moment that is spent, and we spend them, there are no ways to save them. The concept of saving time is an oxymoron, because that doesn't happen. There is no time that is saved. There is merely time that passes. And that time that passes is either used or it's not used. But there's no time that is saved. That's not a reality. So having that, just set that on the shelf for a second, if you would. Go with me to the last part of the Gospel of John. The Lord will be with me and you for a little while this evening. I want to look at the experience of Peter that's found here at the end of this gospel. John chapter 21. You recall that Peter was an individual described in the Bible as having somewhat of a forceful personality. Peter was impetuous. Peter was apt to speak as often or not, and sometimes the things that Peter would say would be the exact right thing. When he would exclaim, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God," it was the exact right thing to say. Or to say, "Lord, where else shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life." But there were times that Peter would, in his impetuousness, say things that he'd be rebuked for. I remember one time Christ describing what would happen to him in Jerusalem, and Peter telling him that's not the case, and the Lord rebuking sharply for it. But during the last few days of the life of Christ, the last hours leading up to, really, Peter had told Christ that regardless if everyone else in the world forsook him, that he would stay faithful to Jesus Christ. And Jesus told Peter, he said, "Peter, before the cock crows, before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me three times." I'm sure that Peter thought there's no way that that can be the case. It's an impossibility. My devotion to Christ is too great. My love for Christ is too sincere. There is no way that this that he has said could be the case. And I wonder if somehow that was partly in Peter's mind there on the outskirts of the garden when he drew his sword. As if he was going to prove, no, I'm willing to fight to the death for you, Christ. And Christ told him to put away his sword. But it turned out that Peter's courage and his faithfulness failed him. And as Christ was being mocked and tried in a kangaroo court, Peter, being unwilling to completely leave the scene at that time, had gotten close, you recall. And I don't know exactly how it looked, but in my mind, Christ is in a room or a courtyard or a chamber, and there's and Peter's outside of that to a degree, over near a fire, but where he can see what's going on with Christ. Kind of how I picture it in my mind. And on three separate occasions there in the span of those few hours, someone said, "Wait, aren't you one of his friends? Aren't you one of the ones that was a follower of this Jesus of Nazareth?" And all three times, Peter says, "No, I don't know the man." The last time, cursing, as he said that he didn't know him. And in that moment, Christ looks at him across whatever space that was. And Peter knows that Jesus has heard him. That Jesus knows exactly what Peter has said and done. And he goes out, weeping bitterly. And when we start John 21. We start John 21 post-resurrection of Christ. Christ has already been resurrected. But not only has Christ already been resurrected, as Christ already rose from the dead, he's appeared to the disciples twice already. Once in a locked upper room where they were there because they were essentially hiding for fear of the Jews, and he appeared to them and showed them that the rumors that they were hearing were true. And a second time appearing again so that Thomas could see that his Lord was indeed risen. But when we get to John 21, the story in the 21st chapter of John is the story of Peter. Because what we find in John 21 is a man who does not know what to do. Now you think about it. The one that you've been following for 3.5 some odd years perhaps has been proven to be the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead. Now you would think that would give cause for courage, for vigor, certainly for excitement. What is it that he's going to have us do? What is about to happen with this that he's going to fill us with? What are the next directions that he's going to give us? You would expect, particularly with someone with the impetuous and passionate nature of Peter, you would expect to find Peter quivering like a hunting dog that's on point. Just, Lord, turn me loose and let me go. You've risen from the dead. I've seen you twice. Let's go. What are we going to do now? We don't find Peter that way. Why don't we? Because Peter doesn't even know if Christ still wants him. Doesn't know. He's seen Christ twice. And the subject hasn't come up. I suspect some of you have experienced that before. Being humans, I can tell you that more than once in my life, I have experienced that. When I've wronged someone in such a way or I've harmed them, or I have gone contrary to them in such a way that all I can feel is the damage to the relationship. And when that happens, when you're around that other person, you find this odd conflict of emotions where you want to talk about it and somehow address it and get it out of the way, and at the same time, it's the last thing in the world that you want to hear. And it just sits there in the space between you. That's where Peter was. On one hand, Christ was risen from the dead, but on the other hand, does he want to meet anymore? Will I be allowed to be a part of his inner circle? Will I be allowed to be even a disciple anymore? Peter doesn't know. And so instead of an excited, an enthused Peter, who is charged with the knowledge that his master is alive, never to die again, in John 21, we find a man who says, I'm going fishing. Why not, right? Peter doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know if his relationship with Christ can be repaired. He has no idea. James and John go with him. And Thomas and Nathaniel. And they go out on a ship and they begin to fish, and they fish all night and they don't catch anything. And it's long about daybreak, they see a man standing on the shore and they don't know who he is. And he calls out to them, they're a few hundred yards offshore, he calls out to them and he asks them essentially if they've caught anything. And they say no. And he says, well, try letting down your net on the other side of the ship. And they do that. And the multitude of fishes that they catch is so great, they're not able to draw the net up in to the boat. And immediately one of them says, that's the Lord. And what does Peter do? Peter's fishing, and he's wearing nothing or mostly nothing at the time. He throws his coat around him and he jumps overboard. Now, you look at that and it looks off. You know, Peter, you can't help the rest of the guys row the boat in? No, he can't. Because all of a sudden, there's a moment. Even if it just gives him 15 minutes or a half hour, whatever it is, all of a sudden there's a moment for him to get one-on-one with Christ. And maybe if he can get one-on-one with Christ, the subject will finally come up. Well, guess what? Doesn't happen. The boat comes to shore. Peter walks over there and pulls the load up, the net up with the fishes. Why? There's no reason to stay over there near Christ. Christ isn't going to talk about it. And that weight that is there hasn't gone anywhere. And that question in Peter's mind of does he still even want me remains unanswered. So they eat. And finally, the opportunity that Peter has both dreaded and at the same time wanted comes to pass. And by the language of the Scriptures, to the best of my knowledge, apparently Christ and Peter go for a walk. And I say that because later on in the conversation, Peter refers to John who had been following. If someone is following, then you've gone for a walk or something of that nature. He didn't say who was sitting nearby. So apparently, Peter and Christ go for a walk. And Jesus looks at Peter. I wonder what that was like. And they walk in silence for a while. Was there any small talk, or was the only sound the crunching of their feet on the sand and the small pebbles near the shore? I don't know. But Jesus turns to Peter and he says, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Now, we need to run just for a second, because it's going to be important, to the original language of the Scriptures. I am no Greek scholar. I don't pretend to be, and don't have the intellectual capacity to be one. The biggest help to me is a good English dictionary when I'm trying to study the Bible. But there are times that, particularly when several words in the original languages are translated into the same one for us, to know what word was used gives us a weight and a flavor, as it were, of the way the conversation, the original word was used. And in the Greek language, there are three words that are translated generally in English as the word love. One is the word eros, and that is physical love or attraction between a man and a woman. I don't know if that particular word is ever used in the Scriptures, to my knowledge. There's another word that is translated love, and it's the word phileo. And that's a love of companionship, a brotherly love. It is a love that is drawn out because there is something in the other person that has caused you to love them. Their companionship, their friendship, their gifts, their charitableness, their love towards you, whatever it was, it draws that out of you. And that's a wonderful thing. It's an important thing. It's a phileo love. We get the word Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. But there is a degree of quality of loves. And the third word that's translated love in the Scriptures is the Greek word agape. And that is the greatest love. And the reason I can say that is the greatest love is because that is the love that God loves with. That is the love that we are to love with, at times commanded to, and in times I trust able to love with because of the love of God that's shed abroad in our hearts. But that's the greatest love. It's the agape love. And this conversation between Christ and Peter goes like this. In that first question, Christ looks at Peter and he says, Simon, son of Jonas, do you agape love me? Well, if you're Peter, how are you going to answer that? You can't say yes. You cursed and sworn that you didn't know the man. You know in your heart it would be rank hypocrisy to say, absolutely, God, I agape love. He can't do it. No matter how much he might want to, Peter can't do it. So Christ says, Peter, do you agape love me? And Peter says, Lord, you know I phileo love you. To get a sense of that, I want you to imagine a couple who have been dating for a while, and they've not been moving at the same speed, and that happens sometimes. Because human beings are different. And one asks the other, "Do you love me?" And the other looks at them and smiles and says, "I really like you." All right, you can see how that would be, and there's a similarity in this conversation to that. He says, Simon, do you agape love me? And Simon, he can't say. He doesn't trust his own hypocrisy with what he's just been through 3 days before to be able to say, Lord, I agape you. So he says, Lord, you know I phileo you. And Christ says, feed my lambs. Christ asks him a second time, Simon, do you agape love me? Peter says, Lord, I phileo love you. both of those times that had to hurt for Peter not to be able to answer the question that Christ was asking him with a question of yes. But look at the kindness of Christ. When Christ asks Peter the third time, he changes the question. And he says, Simon, do you, phileo, love me? Now, Peter's reaction is painful. Now, you think about that imaginary couple who said, well, do you love me? And the other one said, well, I really like you. If they go, well, do you really like me? There's going to be a sense of hurt there, that my inability to tell them I love them now has them asking me if it's even the case that I really like them. And it hurts Peter. Peter's grieved because the third time Christ asks him and questions him, he doesn't ask him about agape love anymore. He reduces it to phileo love. And Peter says, Lord, you know all things. Thou knowest that I, phileo, love you. And Christ said to him, feed my sheep. I look at that and you get a sense of Peter's pain because of him seeing his Lord reduce, as it were, the question that had been asked the first two times. But we also have to look at that and see such tremendous compassion on the part of Christ. There's a song in your songbook that I love. It's called Spirit of God, Descend Upon My Heart. It says, Spirit of God, descend upon my heart. Wean it from earth, through all its pulses move. Stoop to my weakness, mighty as thou art, and make me love thee like I ought to love. Christ has stooped to the weakness of Peter. He has stooped to the weakness of this child of his who is looking inside and sees his betrayal of God and feels the hypocrisy of even uttering the words, I love you, and has asked him a question, though, that he can say yes to. Sometimes you and I get there, don't we? We rebel against God. We deny God in some way. And many times it's in a way that only God sees. He is the only one that's aware of the way in which we denied Him or rejected Him or offended Him. And we say, if anybody else knew, they would see what a hypocrite that I am. I tell you, child of God, I have felt that before. And some of you may have walked in that same experience. And then we wonder, does He still even want me? Is there any point? We don't wonder necessarily about our eternal salvation, but we wonder, am I any use at all anymore in the kingdom of God? Is there any reason that God would want me to continue to be around His people? And here the compassionate Christ not only gives Peter a question that he can answer and say yes to, grievous to him, though it may be to hear the question reduced, he's still able to say yes to that question. To that question he can say, Lord, I know and you know that although my love is weak, although my love is imperfect, I do have a love for you, Christ. And then the two words that I wonder if it was the words that Peter most wanted to hear in the entire world. He said, follow me. Peter, stay by my side. Peter, don't go anywhere. Peter, I know your love is imperfect. I know your failures. I know your weaknesses, but I know your strengths. And Peter, I know your heart. And although you see yourself as damaged goods that surely couldn't be of any use to God in His service here in this world, Peter, follow me. because I do want you. And there's nowhere else that I want you to go. You stay by me and follow me. What must that have been like for Peter? What relief would that have been to know that just like us, although our love is imperfect, our love fails, and sometimes we wonder, if I am such a hypocrite on the inside, would God have any use for me at all? He still says to you, and He still says to me, just like He said to Peter, follow me. Follow me. Stay close. Well, right before He says, follow me, He tells Peter something. He says in verse 18, verily, verily, I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee, and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. This spake he, signifying by what death he should glorify God. The Bible doesn't tell us, but traditional history tells us that Peter was eventually crucified. Some traditional history tells us that Peter's wife was crucified beside him, and that Peter was given the option that if he would recant his confession and devotion to Christ, that his wife would be spared. And that Peter would not do it. And then on top of that, he said, I'm not worthy to die in the same way that my master did, crucifying me upside down. I wonder, Brother Michael, if as Peter hung there, gasping out those last few ragged breaths, if he perhaps did not whisper, yea, Lord, you know that I am agape, I love you. But Christ tells Peter that, Peter, there's a day coming, and there's an intimation here in the words, I would take it that way, that day might not be too far off, Peter. And apparently it wasn't too far off in the future. It still has some years. And I take the rest of this reading to understand that Peter got it. He recognized that Christ was talking about the death that was waiting for him as a martyr for Jesus Christ. And he turns in verse 20. He says, then Peter, turning about, seeth the disciple whom Jesus loved following him, John, the writer, which also leaned on his breast at supper and said, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee? So Peter, he just hears these words. It says, Peter, you have a hard death coming, and it's not too awful hard in the future. Peter turns and sees the apostle John, and he says, Lord, what about this guy? That's our nature, isn't it? Okay, well, Lord, if this is my road, what's so-and-so's road going to be like? You know, I don't fault Peter. I'm the same way. You know, how many times when we were kids, when we would get a piece of dessert, when Mom would put it on the plate, we'd look at it, yeah, and what did my brother get? You know, just to, you know, in case there was any reason for me to suggest that maybe some of that should have been moved over. That never worked for me, Brother Dan. You know, I eventually learned, you know, just to eat what was given to me. But, you know, there was always that thought in mind that maybe I could have some transfer to you. So Peter wants to know, but what's going to happen with John? And Christ looks at Peter and he says, if it's my will that John tarry till I come, what is that to thee? In other words, he says, Peter, if it's my will that this man lives until the day that I come back, what does that do to you? How does that change the command I've given you to follow me? And John quickly explains that Christ didn't say he was going to live that long. He said, what if he did? But Christ says, Peter, whatever happens to someone else, it doesn't change the instruction you still have. Follow me. Now you and I, friends, every single one of us, we all have a different road. Our lifespans, when I look across this room, I see folks who by the normal calculations of life are closer to the end of the road than I would expect to be, and some that are much farther behind. It doesn't change for any of us the command that Christ gives, which is, follow me. If you have one day left on this earth, you know what you're supposed to do with it? Follow Christ. If you've got 10 years left on this earth, guess what we're supposed to do with it? Follow Christ. If God grants you, if you're young, and God grants you that you've got 80 or 90 or 100 years out in front of you, stretched out on a path that you can't even begin to see the end of, do you know what the command is to you? He says, follow me. You say, well, but I'm not going to get it right. Well, you're right. You're not going to get it right. I haven't gotten it right. None of these brethren have gotten it right. None of us are going to get it right. But God knows that. The Bible says in Psalm 103, for He knoweth our frame. God knows everything about us. He knows our faults. He knows our failures. He knows our strengths. He knows our weaknesses. He knows that you and I are not going to get the discipleship of Christ perfect. But He still says, follow me. It says He knows our frame. Christ knew who He was talking to here with Peter. He knows that each one of us are enlivened dust. But He says to us, follow me. Follow me. We have days that are measured out in hours. Hours that are measured out in minutes, and minutes that are measured out in seconds. And regardless of what kind of a mess we've made in the past, regardless of how greatly imperfect our love for Christ has been, tonight, we have a few more hours to follow Christ. And if He gives us tomorrow, guess what? We have one more day in which to try to follow Christ. Lay aside the imperfections of your love for Him. Satan wants us there. He wants us over in the corner, clutching our imperfections and our failures close to ourselves, attempting to hide it from everyone else that sees it, weighed down and able to go forward in service to Christ because of our imperfections. Throw it away, lay it aside, and follow Him. That's what He told Peter, wasn't it? If I could paraphrase without it being sacrilegious, it's as if Christ has said, Peter, get over yourself. Get up and follow me better today than you did that day. And that's the same instruction that you and I have. Forget about yesterday. Yeah, we didn't get yesterday right. But it doesn't change the command to follow Him. And it doesn't change the fact that He still calls us to be His disciples. Yes, He still does want imperfect human beings who can't ever get it exactly right. He still tells them, follow me. I love you and I appreciate you.